session number 17352, Reel 4.
Mr. Crampton, Reel 4.
Yes, we were on the train going across. Well, it eventually got into Naples, everybody covered with black soot. And I found myself in a wonderful great palace there, which was the holding camp. Well, every rank, every unit was represented there, all waiting to get their draft to their regiments. And I discovered then where my regiment was. It was up, having crossed the River Volturno, was waiting for the next move. So I, with my six riflemen, set off on an American lorry. We hitchhiked to the Volturno River, and where we found our brigade headquarters, and corps headquarters, sorry. And I began to feel home, at home again with people I knew. And I think it took us 3 days to get to the regiment. The regiment was camped in bivouacs near a place called Monte Camino, where there had been a big battle. It was pouring with rain, and the regiment was camped in a walnut grove, all in bivouacs. And I reported to the colonel, who told me I was improperly dressed because I hadn't got my MC on, and that was the first I heard of it. Then what happened?
How far were they from the front line?
Oh, they were, what, a couple of hundred yards? Perhaps 300? Well, it's on those mountainous places, it's rather hard to say. Sometimes you can be very close and already almost in rifle range, as it were, or 300-400 yards, and be completely safe and have no contact. Then, one re-established oneself with one's friends there.
What job were you given in the battalion?
I was still a company commander. I was still a platoon commander. But I got my second pip by then. I was a lieutenant. And I was put as second in command of the company because my own company commander had been wounded. There was a stranger, who was it? Harry Gallagher. Captain Gallagher had been given the company, and he was a bit wobbly, had a bad knee. Anyway, I was a second in command. I'm platoon commander.
Which platoon and company were
still it? Nine, platoon,
my old
in A company. Yes. Yes. Then what happened? We had Christmas. Yes, we had Christmas there. We were stationed in a convent. There was we were generally moving up and expecting to go right into action and never quite making it. Again, some oddities happened. We had the first leave together in Naples. I'm getting probably dates mixed up now, but I remember that having rejoined the battalion and sort of made contact with everybody again, we had a 48-hour leave in Naples, where we really came across the Americans for the first time. The whole regiment, I think, had leave. And the Americans were sort of all over Naples. And a rather disgraceful thing happened there. Because when I got back to my platoon after this leave, we called them up on parade, still amongst these walnut groves, and they presented me with a capful of medals, which they'd taken off the Americans, ribbons, in fights in Naples.
Why was there so much fighting with the Americans?
They didn't like them. There was a very it was a funny business. They had no... a lot of things came out at that time that we didn't know about. For instance, I mean, our battle in Catania had been held up. We were told, I mean, we had discovered that we were held up waiting for the Americans who had landed at Palermo. Now, that was a disgraceful business. I mean, in retrospect, it all really... See, when we landed at Avola, I told you about that, and landing at Syracuse, we learned later that the Americans who were landing on our left were intended to sweep round with us as a sort of great unit, a big sweep right over Sicily. But they disobeyed orders, and instead of doing that, they went to Palermo, which was in the far corner of Sicily, which was disobeying Monty's orders. They thought, you know, their general, I don't know who he was now, Patton, was it?
Yes.
That's what they should do. And they did. And the next thing, of course, when we had this, we were stuck at Catania, the Americans were not on our left where they should have been. And they'd bogged down the whole of the left road, the north road in Sicily, with clubmobiles and transports which were useless. Whereas we hadn't any transports at all. We went on our feet. They blocked the whole of that, just with inexperience. Of course, it gets through to the troops pretty quickly, this sort of thing. They don't like it. And again, in the landing in, which I wasn't involved with, but I heard about the landing in Salerno, where the Americans, for the first time, had been actually fighting there. I mean, they seemed to miss it in Sicily. But they'd come across the 8th Army, which was a very crack organisation, as you know. And they call them a little Mickey Mouse outfit because they got the Desert Rats, you know. Or all these Mickey Mice doing it. And there were lots of squabbles and bad feeling there. And then it got out about Monty's bet. And that really did... bite deep. Yes, as far as I remember, and it's, of course, I say a long time ago, the bet was made with Eisenhower. It was when the, after Alamein, and the 8th Army was beginning to get on the move, whereas the 1st Army, under Eisenhower, in North Africa, was rather bogged down at Algiers, or just outside Algiers. And Monty bet Eisenhower that he would be in Tripoli first. And he had something like 800 miles to go, and Eisenhower had about 100. And Eisenhower said, what would be the stake? And Monty said, I would like a flying fortress with a staff to fly it, a crew, as my headquarters. And of course then that was ridiculous, you know. And actually Monty won the bet. He got to Algiers before Monty, before Eisenhower.
Got to Tunis,
isn't it? To Tunis. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was a sort of scandal really. And Eisenhower really, he gave him the flying fortress with the crew.
But were the GIs unpopular with the British troops solely because of their conduct of the war?
Yes, they were very, very cocky, and of course very rich compared with the Tommies. They would, of course, swamp Cairo, for instance. They would be filling the restaurants, filling the streets, paying far more than we could possibly afford. And that made them unpopular. They were overpaid, according to the truth. That was the sort of thing. That was ordinary. You could expect that, you know, the sort of jealousies of that sort. We had a certain amount of jealousy with the Aussies, because they were so much better paid. But it was very, very mild once the Desert War had started, and there was really, and they showed their worth and so on. They were very popular after that, of course. And anyway, they were part of the empire. No longer.
Did you witness any of the clashes in Naples?
No, no, no. We were actually my own... We were sort of really being very, very sybaritic and having our manicures and hair washed, Turkish baths and all that. And drinking peacefully in the officers' club there. Didn't get much in the town. No, I didn't witness any of that. I only heard about it. And I was very, very cross. Another thing which made them very unpopular, there was a battle crossing the Volturno, which was the first real battle north of Naples. And it was a very, very sharp battle fought mostly by the remnants of the 8th Army and the 56th Division. When the troops came back for their first leave after that, they found a film crew filming a battle across the Volturno with extras, a mock battle, which would go back to America as the Battle of the Volturno. And they were very cross. They thought, you know, it's the whole thing is phony, it's silly. That sort of thing really got really under the skin of especially the 8th Army, who had been really fighting for 2.5 years and had some awful defeats and had some really, really tough battles in the desert. They were very pleased with themselves, and they had right to be, but they thought these upstart Americans who had no idea what fighting was about should come and film it. And this sort of thing, you know. And again, it spreads amongst the troops, and it gets exaggerated, and they don't. On the other hand, now, we had, at that time, we had exchanges of personnel, and we would send officers over to the American Army, and they would come to us. And we found that they were extraordinarily nice, and we got on frightfully well together. And I think that happened as individuals throughout the whole affair.
Now, you were telling me about Christmas and being on the Volturno, if you can take it from there.
Yes, we passed the Volturno. We were preparing for crossing the Garigliano, which is the next big river and was the runner-up to Monte Cassino. Meanwhile, Monte Cassino had been attacked by the 1st New Zealand force. Get up there, and I've been repulsed. And they were reinforcing that particular attack. From my own point of view, I was back with my platoon, and really, you're still being used by the colonel as a night patroller if when necessary, because that was sort of my métier. And there was one rather amusing thing. We were approaching the Garigliano, and we were spread out over the countryside, just bivouacking for the night. And I was standing in a road, really, which was rather like a ditch, with high banks on either side, and it started to rain. Must have been about 8 in the evening, and it poured and poured and poured. And I was just standing there with my listening and hoping nothing would happen, getting more and more soaked. And the rain was making a noise, it began pouring down. And I had a horrible feeling of heat on the back of my neck. It was really very odd. I turned around, it was a mule, had crept up silently, was breathing over my shoulder. And the mules had brought up the rations for the regiment. There were Maltese muleteers who had been used for transport. That night. The following night, it dried off a bit, and we dug slit trenches up against the Garigliano and established listening patrols all the way along. The following night, I was on duty in my slit trench with my platoon. Very quiet night. Again, late moon. And following morning, couldn't make contact with the left-hand platoon. They'd been stolen in the night completely. The whole platoon had been put in the bag. And we discovered much, much later that the Germans had come up with an English speaker and just spoken, you know, Otto was there, said, friend, and just caught the whole platoon napping. And we didn't hear, of course, that about until the end of the war when they were released. It was a terrifying sort of experience because they were alongside, you know, not 50 yards away. And then the next thing was possibly the, not certainly more than 2 or 3 days later, it was decided that we should cross the Galliano and attack a town held by the Germans called Castelforte. And we approached the river, and in fact, I didn't realise at the time, but I was told when we got down to the river that our battle patrol had been sent across and lost two men on the river, just been washed down in the little canvas boat, you know. Very nice fellow, Sergeant Wolfe was one of them. He was killed that way. And just bad navigation, I think. Anyway, collapsed boat. We crossed quite safely, and my company was being commanded by Captain Grace. And I went up, he was already established in a position, and I went up to relieve him. And we were in a little tiny ditch, not more than 3 feet deep, and against a minefield. And we were being pinned down by machine gun fire. So we stayed there, creeping around until dark, when the company withdrew just a few hundred yards back to the company headquarters, and I was sent out in charge of a patrol to find out, to probe into the position around Castelforte. And we came into this minefield, and then I put my foot on this mine.
Can you describe the whole incident in detail, please?
Well, yes, we came up. I assembled the chaps, I think the patrol must have been about 15 strong, and I led them out into the no man's land, very, very slowly, poking away, you know, finding our way through, and we came across a very steep bank, and I thought it was impossible to sort of crawl along it, so we went down into the valley at the side of it, and again, very, very quietly, poking on, listening all the time. And we heard, in a building ahead of us, we heard various clinkings and so on. We thought it was probably occupied. And I said, well, I indicated we were going around the side of it. And I just walked down onto the edge of this cliff and put my foot on the mine. And then there was the eventually the second explosion, and it really was rather startling, and I was knocked out.
But I think you tried to protect your men, did you not?
Yes, it was an absolute automatic reaction. I felt this thing, you know, you put your foot on something suspicious, and then it went off, the first explosion. And the idea of these jumping jack mines is like a large jam jar, and an aluminium case with two charges. There's one inside and one in a secondary pot. It was like a jam jar inside a jam jar, and the one is a propellant charge which throws this thing up about 5 feet in the air, and then the main charge goes off and it's scatters shrapnel all around at, I say, about a level of about 5 feet, which is absolutely deadly. And just absolutely instinctive reaction, I kept my foot on it. And the second charge went off in the ground. And that's why they gave me the George Medal. But I must say, honestly, that it was a reaction. It was, you know, it wasn't, in a sense, not deliberate. Probably good training, I don't know. Although we were trained not to do that, we trained to fall flat. But...
What would have happened if you had fell flat?
Well, if the thing had jumped in the air, it would have wiped out all of us. Pretty well. If it had gone off 6 foot up, anyway, anybody within range. Yes, it would have killed most of the platoon off, I think. Most of the patrol. Because we're all very close. You have to be at night. You can't spread out. You lose touch with each other. Anyway, then when that mine went off, I was thrown sideways. And I heard the chaps calling stretcher bearers and so on. And again, from this house which we're about to poke, came machine gun fire. Don't think it hit anybody. It was just reaction, you know, something going off in the night in front of you. You shoot. I was lying out there for quite a long time. The first aid chaps came and put a tourniquet on my stump because the foot had been blown off. And then the stretcher bearers came and took me back to the first aid depot, which was just by our company headquarters, only 50, 60 yards behind a little house. And I remember feeling sort of curiously relaxed. I had I'd been using a captured Luger, which I liked. It was a nice pistol, the Luger. And I remember unstrapping it and giving it to my batman, saying, I shan't want this anymore. And then the next day, I went back in a jeep to the number 5th General Hospital. It was in an opera house in Santa Maria, just outside Naples. And I lay there looking at these extraordinary paintings on the ceiling. All the beds were radio over in the opera house.
What did you think of the treatment that you got?
It was excellent. Excellent.
Did you have to have numbers of operations?
Yes, I had one operation there. Then I came off the danger list there and was shipped across to Tripoli. And then I went on a hospital train from Tripoli to Algiers. And I was in a hospital, a tented hospital in Algiers. And there we took a hospital ship back to Avonmouth. Yeah.
We hear nowadays about all this need for counselling that people have. What do you think of all that in relation to what you experienced?
Well, of course, there wasn't such. It didn't enter anybody's head to be counselled. And one didn't know what had hit one, really. Up till that time, I had a sort of exciting war. It's extraordinary that somebody, if you look at it sort of dispassionately, that an art student, an artist, should actually enjoy night patrolling. It's extraordinary. Come to think of it objectively, you know, but I did. Suddenly, anyhow, that was that, and I didn't realise the effect of war until some considerable time later, around about the fifties, and I began to see then. I mean, during the '40s, the late '40s, I must have been an absolutely impossible character. Very, very short-fused. And, after all, I had so many girls, one can scarcely think. And made one very, very strange and arrogant. coming back to England. After all, there's a hero with two medals and a leg. It was a marvellous aphrodisiac. And a wonderful uniform, you know, is the London Ice with the great cockades. Black buttons. No, it was a very, very disturbed time.
But do you think you would have been like that in any case, despite the wound?
I don't know, really. I don't know. But it was a funny thing. So many people in England, I mean, they were so proud of their uniforms. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I had to wear it because I was still serving. But as soon as I possibly could, I got rid of it. Sorry now, because it was a, you know, the children would love it. But I had a very, very violent reaction against all sorts of things.
What were you against?
Oh, any sort of discipline, any sort of order. I didn't get particularly at all political, but it must have been awful.
So what happened in the 50s to change all this then?
In the 50s, I don't know what happened in the 50s. I think I'd got rid of it, I got it out of my system really. Of course I hated having a wooden leg. I mean, one of the things that I loved and always did, and one of the reasons I liked being in the infantry, was I loved walking. And yet one couldn't show, I didn't show resentment about it, because one was alive. Because it was that, it was the battle between being permanently crippled and being alive, which was such a wonderful thing to be, you know. When so many of one's friends have been killed, and some very badly, there one was, you know, out of it. And yet had this bitter savagery inside somewhere.
Did you tend to feel that somebody or something was responsible?
No. No, not that. It was entirely internal. Entirely psychological, I think. I didn't know. It was just confusion. Just straightforward confusion. Didn't know where I was, what I was doing. The only thing that I had, which I'd had twice, were these extraordinary moments. It happened when I was blown up, when I was waiting for the stretcher bearers. I had another of these extraordinary moments of a certainty of immortality. Very strange, but that was really real. And it started after I was teaching until 1950 at the Anglo-French Art Centre in London. I was teaching sculpture. I went in when I was still in uniform. They started this little school. It was that time when I was really, really, really adjusting, or trying to adjust. But then in the early 50s, I began really to try and see what it was that had happened in these moments of sort of exaltation. And then I started sort of searching in the religious sense, really, looking for what the spirit is and what human beings are and why they're here.
And what religious conclusions did you come to?
I got very much involved with various societies